Hello, and welcome back to Story Collider's Stories of COVID-19. I'm your host, Artistic Director Aaron Barker. Today, we're bringing you part two of our episode on decisions. If you missed part one, we shared a story from labor and delivery nurse Amelia Reeves, who has to make a crucial decision about whether to comfort a patient or whether to abide by hospital COVID protocols. And we also spoke with Professor of Law and Psychology Tess Wilkinson-Ryan about pandemic decision-making. I highly recommend checking it out. I know that making decisions right now is definitely on everybody's minds, so I think it will resonate with you. For now, we have two more stories for you on the theme of decisions. Our first story comes from clinician Mati Fadza Lachwayo Davis. It was recorded in her basement in St. Louis, Missouri.
So it's March 2020, and coronavirus is upon us. I'm an infectious diseases doctor, so I'm running around going to meeting after meeting because we're faced with leading the charge. I'm also trying to stay up to date with scientific articles, but there's scarcely any data. I'm trying to answer all the texts coming into my phone from panicked family members and friends, some I hadn't even spoken to in over 10 years. But I'm also 7 months pregnant. And let's just be very clear here. This is not the radiant, glowing, oh, look at her, she's so beautiful, 7 months. This is the, I feel fat, I'm very wide, my back hurts all the time. Not a day goes by that it doesn't hurt. And I really need someone to take this baby out of me immediately. Thanks. So on top of that, I'm grappling with how to reconcile my pregnancy and my work because, like I said, there's no data and no conclusive recommendations. Thank God for my obstetrician, Dr. Philpott, because he makes it black and white. He's like, no seeing patients for you for the rest of your pregnancy. He's like, you have higher risk. You're an infectious disease doctor. So I'm like, how do I do this? I have to figure this out with my bosses. So we come up with a plan for me to focus the remainder of my time on telehealth. And I inherit this new hotline, which is basically this phone that doctors at the John Conkrings Veterans Hospital can call in, tell me what's going on with a potential patient, and then I let them know if they're eligible for one of the very few tests we had at the time. This decision to work from home, not simple for me, not easy by any stretch, because throughout my career, I've dealt with micro and macroaggressions of many kinds. You know, this started in training. You're only here because of affirmative action. Then I'm an HIV provider. You're valuable in this space because you're Black and the patients are Black. Gee, thanks. And then there's the common, when's the doctor coming in? 20 to 30 minutes after I've been doctoring. I mean, it's just like, what? So it's not surprising that I'm anxious. I'm anxious about this. I'm anxious about how my work plan is going to be received by my colleagues. Let me walk you through one example. So it's a typical workday. I'm sitting in my office and there's a knock on my door. One of my colleagues, who I'm friendly with, very friendly, us to come in and run something by me. We're chatting, everything's chill, and somewhere in the middle of this conversation, he jokingly says, I wish I was pregnant so I didn't have to work. Huh? I mean, who says that? I'm just like, I'm almost like looking around like, you, someone else heard that, right? But I'm completely caught off guard. And I do what I normally do when I'm backed against the wall with these random ass micro and macroaggressions, you know, that come with being a woman, being Black, being an immigrant. I laugh. I laugh along to hide the awkwardness. I don't want to be seen as sensitive. I don't want to be perceived as playing some sort of card. So I just laugh and wait until later in the day when I'm talking to one of my female friends and colleagues and I tell her what happened. And I mean, thank the Lord, she responds the same way. She immediately recoils and verbalizes her disgust. So I knew then, I was like, okay, my reaction was valid. And this is the sort of thing that made my insecurities flare as my new work plan developed over the coming weeks, because I would always remember the sentiment behind hurtful comments like that. Not to mention I'm isolated now, right? I'm working from home, so I don't feel like I'm on the front lines. I don't feel like I am. And that sucks, quite frankly. That was short-lived, though, because nothing could be further from the truth. That phone, it was something else, because it rang day and night. Everyone wanted a test. Everyone believed they needed one. And they were pissed. They were highly frustrated. They were angry and they were scared for themselves and for their patients. And so they weren't always nice about it. You know, I only had a handful of tests to approve a day, but people were coming in from everywhere with symptoms or believing that they'd been exposed. It was a nightmare. And as the pressure mounted and the calls kept coming, I wasn't always the most patient. So I realized very quickly, very, very quickly, that I would trade my old schedule in a heartbeat. And that, quite frankly, I am on the front lines. Okay, bump what you heard. I'm on the front lines. I'm also doing telemedicine, though. It's not just this phone, right? I'm writing grants. My research kept going. I'm writing policies for the Division of Medicine. And there's countless other Zoom meetings that I'm a part of. So those 2 months, some of the hardest of my career. I'm not sleeping. Every day I can hear my toddler and nanny running around the house and I can't be with her because I have to work. I hurt. My back hurts all the time because I have the biggest belly known to mankind at this point, right? And I'm uncomfortable. So this was hard. I mean, there's no way to put it other than this was really, really tough. And I don't feel comfortable talking about it with my peers or my supervisors. It's one of the really ugly realities of being the only Black physician in my department is that I don't have the same shared experiences as everyone else. So I don't always feel comfortable talking about things. Certainly not things like this, because I've been counseled before not to complain, because I'll be seen as an emotional woman. And if I talk about it, I'll be seen as a problem. And you can't do that as a Black person. So I just put my head down and work harder. So then finally, the oasis of pure joy came in the middle of all of this. On May 16th, 2020, at 2 a.m., I feel fluid between my legs. You'd think it would be obvious, but no, not to me. I panic. I'm in denial. You wait for this day for 9 months and then it comes and you're like, hell nah. So I wake my husband up and he says, it's time to go. Let's go. It's go time. Still in denial over here. So he's like, please just call the hospital. Speak to a doctor. She'll tell you. He'll tell you. It's time to come in. So this poor woman on the phone at 3 a.m. is trying to tell me, yes, ma'am, you should, yes. Let's get in the car. And I'm like, okay. But as soon as I get off the phone, Google. And I'm like, but babe, look at these articles. I could stay. We have time. Ridiculous. Anyway, finally, about an hour later, I hop in the shower, check our go bag, and drive myself to the hospital while Jesse, my husband, stays at home with a nanny until our babysitter can come to be with her. It's so hard to describe just how incredible of an experience this day is for me, because literally from everyone, from the administrator at the front desk to every nurse on every shift with me over the next 24 hours are just the kindest, most positive people. And I have the most peaceful experience. And I have to say, Dr. Philpott had my back and he fulfilled a promise that he made to me weeks ago. It was Black Maternal Health Week. And I'd been flooded with statistics about Black women dying from childbirth and pregnancy complications left, right, and center. I'm sitting on the edge of my chair in his office. We're speaking. It's the end of the visit. You know, the part where he's like, do you have any questions? And I'm insecure. I don't want to talk about it. Me and him usually have a very light, joking banter. And this was serious for me. This was scary for me. And I sit there and I look him in his eyes. I have tears welling up, but I don't want to cry. And I tell him everything I've been reading. I'm telling him about how Black women are dying at these higher rates than white women and how scared I am that will be me. And he listens. You guys, he's so good, man. He listens. He looks me in my eyes and he simply says, "I got you." And he meant it, because on this day, on the day that I got to have our baby girl, he came in from home on his day off, joking and laughing, and walks in the room, and I think he could see Naniso's head literally there, and he's like, "Oh shit, let's do this." And three pushes later, like a G, she comes out. It was incredible. It was smooth. It was beautiful. I was filled with gratitude. So we submerge ourselves into our new normals as parents of two. You know, I've got a 3.5-year-old and I've got a newborn who chows every 2 hours. I mean, she doesn't miss meals, guys. It's every 2 hours. So I didn't think that anything could rock me from this bubble that we were in. And then George Floyd happened. I couldn't watch it first. I'm not going to lie. I was like, no, I'm not watching. You can't keep doing this to Black people where we just continue to have trauma after trauma after trauma. And on top of that, I've just had a baby. Can I have this moment? Like, come on, man. No. So I'm not watching. And I didn't trust it. I didn't trust it to be more than pain on behalf of the Black community again, meeting this fleeting righteous indignation with the selfies and the hashtags. Nah, man, you can keep it. But as the days mounted, the movement intensified. The protests grew and they spread across the nation, across the world. I couldn't believe it. It was different this time, and I can't tell you why. I don't know if it was the visual, if it's the knee on the neck, if it's the pandemic. I don't know. Maybe it's all of it. But I do know that one night I put Naniso down. You know, she's beautiful. She's peaceful. She's in her crib. And Jesse's sleeping next to me on the other side. And I pop them in. I pop the headphones in. And on my phone, in the dark, I watch it. I watch in horror for 8 minutes and 46 seconds as a Black man is murdered in broad daylight. I feel sick. I feel sick to my stomach. I'm sad. I'm scared. I'm pissed. I mean, what the fuck? And I'm tired of this shit and I feel hopeless and I can't go back to sleep. I just lay there until 2 hours later, Naniso starts crying again to be fed. It's that day that I was done. I found my voice. I stopped questioning myself. I stopped questioning the validity of my experiences in society as a Black immigrant woman. No more. I'm going to speak out against injustice, against systemic racism that's impacted my professional and my personal life for years now, about my very valid experience. Because my voice matters. That's what I know now. Because Black lives matter. And because who I am and what I bring to the table, they all matter. We need to hear these stories from people that look like me, people that sound like me. And as much as this isn't easy for me, being exposed, being vulnerable in this way, I won't be the extrovert's extrovert anymore that just laughs along through micro and macroaggressions. I won't do it. And what I pledge to myself today is that I will use my voice to tell my stories, stories of strength and of pain and of vulnerability and my truth.
That was Mati Fadza Lachwayo Davis. Madi completed her internal medicine residency at the University Hospital's Case Medical Center. She's a clinical instructor at Washington University School of Medicine and an associate program director of the Division of Infectious Disease Fellowship Program. Her passion for community engagement, diversity and inclusion, and patients living with HIV culminated in her becoming the co-chair for the Fast Track Cities Initiative in St. Louis. Thank you so much for sharing this story, Monty. You'll notice over the course of this series that the murder of George Floyd is almost as much a part of these stories as COVID-19 itself. This past summer, we experienced the confluence of two major earth-shattering events, events that will change us forever as a society. And they feel kind of inextricable at times. So as we document this time, we know that this aspect of these past few months is just as important, particularly given the difference in impact on marginalized communities. Before we move on, I just want to give a quick reminder that Story Collider hosts monthly online storytelling workshops. If you're looking to develop your storytelling and communication skills or find a new community during the pandemic, I highly recommend checking them out. Registrations are now open for January courses. Find out more at storycollider.org/workshops. And if you're listening to this series thinking that you have a story about how the pandemic has affected you in a big or small way, get in touch. You can send your story pitches to stories@storycollider.org, or you can pitch through the form on our website. We would love to have you as part of our next COVID-19 series. Our last story on the theme of decisions is from lab director Myra Kunis. The story was recorded at her home in St. Paul, Minnesota. Myra's story was originally developed for a live online show we produced in partnership with American Public Health Laboratories.
Memorial Day in Minnesota signals rebirth after a long winter and really just something to look forward to. And this year of COVID is no different. But I find myself spending Memorial Day working in the lab rather than enjoying the beautiful warm day building yet another multi-million dollar budget to support my public health lab's response to COVID. My 10-year-old son has joined me for the afternoon, which he's helping assemble COVID kits by stuffing Ziploc bags with cold packs. And it feels amazing, just wonderful to have him working by my side after so many distracted and distant hours since this all began. So yeah, hi. I'm the interim director at the Minnesota Public Health Lab. I took over this role when my former boss retired at the end of April. Minnesota's first COVID case was reported on March 6th, which just happens to be my birthday, so yay me. My first month as director has already been the biggest, most unpredictable challenge of my professional career. But in this moment with my son, I actually feel wonderful. This really great, almost confident and strong that I can lead my division through this pandemic. A few hours after my son and I wrap up our work, George Floyd is killed by Minneapolis police 10 miles from my lab. The video of the killing hits social media the next day, followed by local and national news. And I read the reports, but I just cannot bring myself to watch the video. I can't make myself watch another Black man die for no reason. My family and I regularly drive past the memorial of Philando Castile, who was killed by police a few years ago. It is heartbreaking and frustrating to realize how little has changed since then, when I feel so much has changed for me. The protests and memorials for George Floyd quickly begin to spread across Minneapolis and St. Paul, where my family and I live. And two nights after George Floyd is killed by Minneapolis police, the unrest escalates to riots and looting and multiple building fires in Minneapolis, 3 miles from my house. The next morning, the helicopters and sirens are constant at my home. And we just try our best to remain calm and focused on school and work. But just after 1 p.m., I get a message from a coworker that says a mob is heading to the Capitol, which is a block from my lab. I make some calls and confirm that it's actually really quiet at the Capitol, which momentarily just calms my nerves. And then less than 30 minutes later, my deputy commissioner calls and asks how fast I can get everyone out of the lab. Capitol Security is reporting that riots are starting in Midway and crowds are heading to the Capitol. If staff stay, their safety cannot be guaranteed. And I tell her that everything that my team has gone through, the long hours manually processing COVID samples 7 days a week, balancing work, our new normal, a statewide shutdown, school closures, separations from those we love, I cannot put them in harm's way. Yes, of course, we can shut down. And I don't even know why, but I tell her that I live really close to the Midway. And she immediately says, get out of there. Do you have someplace safe to go? And you know those moments when your heart starts beating so hard you can't hear or think? When she said, get out, I didn't really hear much after that. My son and husband packed to head out to a friend's house in the suburbs while I communicate the shutdown of the lab during a pandemic 4 weeks after I took on the interim lab director job. Almost everyone shut down and got out in 45 minutes. A few refused to leave because they were so devoted to getting tests out the door. And I told them to at least leave before dark because there was no way in hell I was going to go down there and make them leave. We decided to keep the lab closed until Monday. We've never closed for 3 days straight, even when the lab flooded 6 years ago. The rest of the day is spent talking with my division leadership about a response plan, keeping up communications, and just trying to answer all of their questions. What if nothing actually happens? Who made this call to evacuate? And on and on. And at some point on one of the calls, I realized that my hands are shaking from adrenaline and exhaustion, and I can't take enough deep breaths to make them stop. My friend pours me a tumbler of whiskey, and I toast one of my teams over video chat and take a drink with a shaken hand. Meanwhile, my husband and son are talking about what's going on back home. My husband is fixated on Twitter, updating us on what's going on. And my son has questions about looting and birding and why that would be part of a protest. And we tell him that sometimes when problems have been ignored for so long, people need to resort to more violent measures to get their voices heard. And as bad as this destruction seems, buildings can be rebuilt. People like George Floyd and Philando Castillo cannot. I finish my day just after 10:30 that night, and my mind just won't stop spinning between work and home, the news, and the sheer guilt for not being there with my neighbors. But eventually, I fall asleep out of sheer exhaustion. The next day feels like a cleanup day at work. We go back to our house. No violence made it to the Capitol, but both St. Paul and Minneapolis burned the night before. The looting came as close as 4 blocks from my house. There's smoldering buildings all along University Avenue and the family-owned Chinese restaurant where we got takeout the week before is destroyed. The Turf Club, which is a music venue just up the street where we spent countless date nights, was looted, set on fire, and then flooded when the sprinkler system went off. Curfew is put in place and the National Guard is deployed to the city streets. Everyone in St. Paul and Minneapolis are preparing for another round that night, boarding up their businesses, posting signs, locally owned, Black Lives Matter, Black owned. The National Guard caravan of sand-colored military vehicles rolled down University Avenue. It felt like New Orleans just after Katrina. As curfew came, I stood outside on my front yard with my neighbors as we shakenly passed the time making small talk. And then suddenly it was just quiet. For once, it was finally quiet. But I was scared for me, for my community, and for my lab. Monday morning, I returned to work. The lab building shares a loading dock with the armory. And so there's literally net military vehicles and concrete barriers in the street outside our building. Countless armed guards stationed throughout the complex, including snipers, on all four corners of the armory roof. At some point, the National Guard blockades a street next to the building, which makes my team really uneasy. And as crazy as it sounds, all I wanted to do was tell my staff to just go work, stop worrying about the military. But I didn't do that because that's crazy. One of my leaders comes to my office and asks if I know what's going on. And of course, I have no idea what's going on. But I say, let's go ask him. We grab our masks. We head up the sidewalk. And as we get closer and closer to a man and woman in full fatigues holding rifles, I feel my body wanting to run back to my lab door. I don't want these people here with their guns. And I do not want to ask them what they're doing. But my team is scared, and this is the only way I know how to get some answers. So I keep walking. When I ask about the change in position, the guard seems to not even understand the question, as if randomly blockading a city street is just normal. And as she struggles to hold multiple lunches in styrofoam containers, chips, and a rifle, I realize that we're all just doing the best we can in the jobs we choose. I go back to the lab and tell staff it's just going to be fine. Everything's fine. The military are here to help keep the peace. And I don't know if I believe it, but I say it over and over again. I'm the boss of 150 people, and I've been the boss for exactly 1 month. I need to be there for my division and my family when they're scared, and I can tell them what I want to believe, even if I'm scared too. I don't know what's coming next. Summer is almost over. COVID is showing no end in sight. Systemic racism continues on. And I continue to have hope for change that needs to come to Minnesota for Black lives in our community. What I do know is I'm so much stronger than I ever believed, and I can do this. Thank you.
That was Myra Kunis. As we heard, Myra has been the interim lab director for the State of Minnesota Public Health Lab since May 1st, 2020. She has worked in private and public labs since obtaining her Master's of Science degree in Earth and Ecosystem Sciences from Tulane University. She finds her groove with quality assurance, safety, process improvement, finance, IT, customer service, and operations. Or, she says, pretty much what most lab staff avoid like the plague. The Story Collider is so grateful to Monty and Myra for sharing their stories. The Story Collider is also very grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. This podcast series is produced by me, Erin Barker, with assistance from Story Collider's Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg and Senior Podcast Editor Jun Chen. Special thanks goes out to Story Collider's board, our operations manager, Lindsay Cooper, and our new interim executive director, Leslie Griesbach-Schultz, without whom none of this would be possible. The stories featured in today's installment were produced by Eli Chin and Emma Yarbrough, respectively. The theme music is by Eva Gertz of the Fulton Street Music Group. Stay tuned for our next episode, Connections, on Friday. Until then, this is Story Collider signing off. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, love each other. Thanks for listening.